From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to keep your knees safe and your body free of injury, quit running. That's the advice a lot of doctors give today amid an epidemic of running injuries. But a new movement from the remote Copper Canyons in Mexico has runners taking off their shoes and going barefoot.
Modern running shoes are the virus. They are the cause of the problem.
It's such a freeing sensation to run barefoot. It almost takes you back to your childhood.
Adventures in barefoot running, coming up. Also, Life on the Run. We'll hear readings from the celebrated Japanese novelist and marathoner Haruki Murakami, and the latest in running science.
When they studied the cells of aging athletes, athletes in their 50s and 60s who ran quite a bit, they were fairly serious runners, they had younger cells.
I happened to be flipping through a Mexican magazine, and I see a picture of what looks like some old man in a bathrobe and sandals. And the caption said he had won a 100-mile race through the Rocky Mountains. It was a 55-year-old man who had not only run 100 miles in sandals, but beat an elite core of American ultra runners. So what I wanted to find out was, now what's that guy doing that the rest of us aren't?
That's writer and journalist Christopher McDougall. Laid low by running injuries and a doctor's order to take up biking instead, McDougall stumbled across the Tarahumara tribe of Mexico in a magazine. They seemed to be an incredibly reclusive tribe of super runners who could run for days without tiring, with smiles on their faces. McDougall set out on a quest to find them and learn their secrets for his book, Born to Run.
It turned out to be a pretty difficult job just to try to track down the Tarahumara. Where did you start?
I had this misconception, as I think a lot of us do, that anything in the modern world is reachable if you just sort of get the right, you know, travel connections. So I asked around, and nobody would agree to take me down to the Copper Canyons. I did find a guy who knew a guy whose brother had been down there before to bring, like, school supplies to some of the little schoolhouses along the rim of the canyon. But as it turned out, though, Salvador knew his stuff. And after about a week of trekking on foot and by, you know, four-wheel drive through these incredible forests and weaving our way sort of clandestinely through drug cartel territories, we actually located a little Tarahumara settlement where the greatest Tarahumara runner, Arnulfo Quimade, still lives today. So Arnulfo was, as the Tarahumara are, he was very hospitable. You know, he came out of his hidden hut, and we're actually standing on his roof before I even realized that we were near his house. You know, Salvador said, "We're here." I looked around. I didn't see anything. He was like pointing down. We're on his roof. Arnulfo came outside, and he brought us this big basket of sweet limes. And we sat down, and we sucked limes, and we looked at each other. And I asked question after question for about 4 hours. And Arnulfo said absolutely nothing. He just kept gazing off over the river, just waiting for me to go away. And finally, you know, as the sun was setting over the canyons, we finally slunk away.
Why wouldn't he answer your questions?
You know, I learned that later on. We had the good fortune to find a little Tarahumara schoolhouse a few miles down the river. And the schoolmaster had spent some time out of the canyons up in Chihuahua. And what he told me was that, you know, back in the times of the conquistadors and subsequently when different colonizers have tried to press gang the Tarahumara into service, and that includes gold miners and silver miners and logging bandits and now the drug cartels, the way they would approach the Tarahumara village is to start asking questions, you know, where is everybody? How, who's around? Who's the strongest guy? Who can carry the gold for us? And the Tarahumara have learned just never answer questions when posed by strangers.
Hmm. So the Tarahumara wouldn't talk to you, but then you began to hear whispers about this mysterious white guy, the Caballo Blanco, the white horse, who'd maybe found the Tarahumara and had a relationship with them. Did you find him?
What happened was Angel, the schoolmaster, let us camp out that night at the bottom of the canyons outside of his schoolhouse. And the next morning at daybreak, we saw a huge band of Tarahumara children playing the typical Tarahumara running game. They were in ages from like 5 to 13, and they're running back and forth across this one-mile stretch of path. And in about an hour, they ran about 6 or 7 miles. this is like the little recess before they started classes. And to me, it's still mind-boggling that six-year-old kids would run like a fast trail 10K before starting school in the morning. And as I was watching them run, I was really sort of energized because it was a kind of running that I'd never seen before, just really light and fast and effortless. Kids were joyful. Everybody's having a blast. And I started to really press the schoolmaster with questions like, you know, who can show me how to do that? Just someone give me a lesson. That's all I want to learn. And he said, look, none of the tatamata here are going to talk to you. Just take that as a fact. It's not going to happen. The guy you want to talk to is the white horse. And that hung in the air. I'm like,
this sounds like a Western.
Yeah, I know. And what white horse? And he starts to tell me the story about some mysterious stranger who had arrived down in the canyons 15 years earlier. No one knew his name or where he'd come from or how old he was. But all they knew was he was a pretty gracious guy. He was like ghostly pale. He'd been hanging out in the canyons for more than a decade. And that he had learned how to run like the Tarahumara. He had turned himself into a 21st century Tarahumara. And as it turned out, we ended up tracking him down in the little town of Creel up on the ridges of the canyon.
What was he like?
I had found Caballo at a unique time in his life, at the only time in his life, I think, where he would be willing to answer questions. And the reason why is because, as I've been told, he'd gone down there to learn the secrets of the Tarahumara. And the first step toward that is by being trustworthy and discreet and not bothering them. And the last thing he wanted was a bunch of guys like me hanging around. On the other hand, he was really concerned that in our lifetime, the Tarahumara could essentially vanish from the planet. There are fewer than 40,000 traditional Tarahumara who still exist. And literally day by day, their numbers diminish as the cartels push deeper and deeper into the canyons. So Caballo had this idea that what if he set up his own race down there in the bottom of the canyons on the Tarahumara's home territory, which would let outside runners come in and go toe-to-toe with the Tarahumara and then go back to their homes with these tales of this ancient wisdom that the rest of us can benefit from.
Mm, you became his publicist.
So right.
Did he figure out, and did you, what is so special about the way the Tarahumara run? I mean, do they have some genetic advantage?
When someone does something way better than the rest of us, there's only two explanations. Either, as you said, there's some kind of weird genetic mutation, or they're exactly the same as we are, and they just do it differently. And in the case of the Tarahumara, it's just B. They are exactly the same as we are. They just do it differently. But beyond that, what I started to understand as I started to dig into the anthropology of humans as just distance runners is that not only are they the same as we are genetically, they are the same as we have been for most of our existence. The Tarahumara are only doing what humans have done for nearly 2 million years before we became afraid of running.
What do you mean before we became afraid of running?
You know, it's a funny thing if you start to read into folklore and mythologies and any kind of legends that running is always associated with freedom and vitality and eternal youth. You know, the ancient kings of Egypt used to have to run a long distance course every year in order to maintain their hold on the throne. And there are Egyptian kings that were doing this into their 90s. There are tales of Navajos and Apaches and Hopis who were running long distances deep into old age. Almost every indigenous group uses distance running as a rite of passage from childhood into adulthood. But it's only in our lifetime, literally since the 1970s, that running has become associated with fear and pain and injury. You never see that written anywhere. You never read accounts of running in the 40s and 50s and 60s where people are afraid of their knees or their IT bands or modern running shoes are the virus. They are the cause of the problem. We have tried to out-engineer nature, and the result has been, as it often is when we try to outthink nature, we have set forward this epidemic of unintended consequences known as the modern running injury.
So is this the Tarahumara secret, just that they run barefoot or in flimsy little sandals? Is that it?
You know, I wish it could be more dramatic than that. You know, I wish they had some kind of magical herb that I could sort of mass produce and sell. But essentially, it's it. What made all the difference for me was when I took off my shoes and started to run in my bare feet and learned how to run gently on my bare feet, that was it. Problem solved.
You're kidding.
A couple of things that happened, Ann. Number one was, so there I was in September of 2005, and Caballo was going to put this race on in 9 months. He said, come back in March, I'm going to put on this 50-mile race. And if you can run 50 miles, you can participate in this race. Well, at that point in September, I had not run a step in about 4 or 5 years. So I am absolutely at level zero. You can't be more of a beginner than I was. Within 9 months, I went from not running a step at all and being a good 50 pounds overweight. 9 months later, I could participate in this 50-mile race, had lost 40 pounds, and have not had an injury since.
So what was it like for you running in that 50-mile race with the Taro Mara?
It was, I could say, almost indescribable. It was so fun. More than anything else, I think that sort of lightning bulb over your head moment, like, hey, it really works. You know, I wasn't sure until this moment. But now that I am, 45 miles into a 50-mile run in a canyon in 102-degree heat, and I'm still moving, it really works. And that's what was so absolutely electrifying.
Were you surprised? I mean, can you take me back to that race? Was the whole thing pleasant, or what was it like from beginning to end?
You know, until the moment, literally the second the starting gun fired in the air, I had no idea if it was actually going to happen. Because after I left Caballo and returned to the United States, you know, I had this idea, and he had taught me a few tricks for how to run like the Taro Mara, but, you know, I wasn't really sure if this was going to work. And it was just one bizarre, lucky coincidence after the other. I happened to be doing a different magazine assignment, started to chat with a guy who trains endurance athletes in Wyoming. I mentioned the Taro Mara, and this guy is suddenly on fire because he's always wanted to learn about the Taro Mara. So he made me a deal. He said, look, I will coach you. I'll do your training for you. And in return, you got to get me in that race. So I strike a deal with this guy who turns out to be a fantastic coach. The next thing was Scott Jorick, who's the greatest ultra runner on planet Earth. He read an article I wrote for Runner's World, and suddenly he was in. Then a guy named Barefoot Ted, who lives in Burbank and trains by pulling his wife and daughters down the streets in a rickshaw. He wants to get in. And then these two surfers from Virginia Beach who, when they're not, lifeguarding and surfing, are out running 100-mile races in their surf shorts. They want to go in.
So if nothing else, you met some really interesting people.
Yeah. So what I got a chance to see was not only did this race come together, but I was able to see before my own eyes that there are definitely transferable skills there. That the things that Taro Mara are doing, other people are stumbling upon those secrets by accident, and they work.
So the starting gun went off. At what point in the race did you realize this is really fun?
So there we are, all lined up in the middle of nowhere, this town of Urique at the bottom of the canyons. And of course, Jen and Billy, the two surfers, were missing. Literally, we started the countdown. We're down like, 10, 9, 8, 7. Where are Jen and Billy? Nobody knows. They come rocketing up to the starting line with 3 seconds to go. Bam, the shotgun fires off. And suddenly there were about 25 Taro Mara and about 7 of us, non-Taro Mara runners, all, charging pell-mell down this trail. And Caballo's genius was, rather than a traditional race course, he'd set this race course up in the form of a Y. So the course was constantly doubling back on itself at different branches. So you could not only be in the race, but you could actually see the race unfolding in real time, because as the leaders were coming back down one branch of the Y, they were coming toward me, so I could see everybody, and then they go up and down again. So for the first, 20 or 30 miles, I always had somebody to look at, and which is utterly enthralling. I could watch Scott Jorick, the greatest American ultra runner, going stride for stride with Arnulfo Quimade and Silvino, two of the Taro Mara runners. So I could do like a real-time comparison of these guys. And as the race progressed, things were going really, really well. I was startled by the fact that I ran the fastest 26 miles I've ever run in my life in the first half of a 50-mile race. But where things started to get tough was right around mile 45 and 46 when, this being a pretty disorganized race, it ran out of water. And there I was, miles from the finish line with no water, 102 degrees. And the only person offering me any aid was Barefoot Ted, who offered me a drink of his own urine. Which I
Did you accept or decline?
Politely declined. But what had happened was, the Taro Mara have a philosophy called Korima, which sounds a lot like karma, and it's a similar proposition. The Taro Mara have no currency. They have no money, and their entire financial system is based on trading favors. And they have this belief that when you give something away, it's as if it were never yours in the first place, and you have to keep giving things in order to get things. Well, a couple of days earlier, I had given this guy I met down in the canyons a knife. He had admired my knife. I gave it to him. And out of the blue, as I'm sitting down here miles from the finish line, utterly wiped out by heat and dying of thirst, I see this guy coming over the ridge of a hill shaking these two cans of ice-cold mango juice. And he'd come out looking for me. He thought maybe I needed a drink. And you know, at the very moment I needed one, he appeared.
Christopher McDougall is the author of Born to Run. He's a dedicated, injury-free barefoot runner. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him. Coming up, Mythbusters about running and exercise. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Gretchen Reynolds is a sports writer and runner. She covers the latest in exercise science and writes about what she finds for the New York Times Magazine's Phys Ed column. Today, researchers are digging deep into the world of exercise physiology and busting more than a few myths along the way. For instance, everybody knows running is tough on your knees, right?
As a fellow somewhat aging athlete, I am very happy to report that that is not true. There is,
really?
In fact, very good evidence that running under certain circumstances is actually quite healthy for your knees. It may even be protective against arthritis. I say that and I can hear the people saying, I know lots of people with achy knees who run. And the caveat is, if you have never injured your knee, particularly if you've never torn an ACL or in other ways changed the stability of your knee, then you can probably run into your 90s with no problem. The knee is made to be run on. It's made to be walked on. And in fact, walking and running on your knee will in fact generally make the cartilage in your knee somewhat healthier.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's that wearing away of the cartilage that I've read most about. I think that people are concerned, especially that excessive running can cause damage. And you're saying that's the research seems to show that's exactly the opposite, unless you have a predisposition.
There was a very interesting study done out of Stanford that followed runners for about 30 years. And it's not easy to do that, partly because a lot of people don't run for 30 years. And they started with runners in their 50s and 60s. And as I said, they followed them through 60 years. And what they found was the runners actually wound up with a lower incidence of knee arthritis than a matched group of similarly healthy people who didn't run. And so the evidence seems to be that if you're lucky enough to have made it into your 50s without knee arthritis, you can almost certainly keep running into your 90s, slower and slower. I could tell you get slower and slower, but it will not hurt your knees in general.
Is this true only of serious runners, people who run, I don't know, 30 to 50 miles a week? What about occasional runners? Do their knees also last longer, look better?
Well, I don't know if they look better. They tend to be knobbly as you get older no matter what. But almost certainly any amount of running is likely to not hurt and may well be protective. And again, in the Stanford study, for instance, that 80 and 90-year-old runners were not running much and they were probably really walking. And it may have been as little as 90 minutes over the course of a week, but their knees were healthier than similar people of the same age who didn't run. So you don't have to stop running to protect your knees.
You talked about having a healthier brain. It's one of the things that I read in your blog. There is evidence, I gather, that exercising, and I assume it's just exercising, not just running, exercising can actually increase brain cells?
It can. I must say it's the most encouraging bit of research that I have ever read is there's very clear evidence that exercising, and it does not have to be running, it does appear that it needs to be aerobic. There needs to be at least some movement of blood to the brain. But if you have even fairly low-level walking. What happens is you do get blood flow to the brain, you get various growth factors moving into the brain, and they have shown very clearly you get new brain cells growing as a result of the exercise. And that has a really strong impact, or appears to have a very strong impact, on cognitive ability. People who exercise do better on tests of cognition, of memory. They're less anxious. It's really quite profound.
It's astonishing. And there was another of your articles that suggested that people who exercise regularly actually look younger than people who don't.
Yes, my other particularly favorite area of research, wonderful news for all of us who are growing a little older. They have studied the cells of athletes. And every piece of your DNA has on the end of it this little cap that's called a telomere. And every time that cell, the DNA divides, a little tiny bit of the telomere is snipped away. And scientists think that that is protective. It's meant to protect the cell and the DNA. But what happens is if all of the telomere is snipped away, the cell itself and the DNA either dies or becomes sleepy. It essentially stops operating. So that cell is old. And when they studied the cells of aging athletes, athletes in their 50s and 60s who ran quite a bit, they were fairly serious runners, but they found their telomeres were at least 40% longer than those of aged matched people. They had younger cells. And that's pretty exciting.
There are a lot of things about this research that change the way we approach exercise, aren't there? There's, for instance, the whole business of running shoes, which is such a huge industry. There has been a lot of scientific study, or at least pseudo-scientific study, suggesting that people know what kind of shoes you should wear. But I'm gathering from looking at some of the research you've looked into, we may not know nearly as much as we thought we did.
No, and this is another instance where a certain mythology takes hold. And I've been a runner for decades now, and I have always been told and believed that you buy shoes based on the shape of your foot, whether you have a high arch or a low arch. And I've gone into running shoe stores, and they look at your foot. They even sometimes draw around your foot. And they tell you if you have a high arch, you need a very cushioned shoe because your foot will not bend as much. And if you have a very low arch, you need a really strong, sturdy motion control shoe. And those tend to be the heaviest shoes. They also recommend those frequently for heavier runners. And none of this was, in fact, based on good science. And when they actually started looking closely at whether putting people in shoes based on the shape of their foot actually reduced injury rate, it did not. And in some cases, it actually increased injury rate.
How much research has there really been done on this? I gather the U.S. military did some, and that's a lot of people anyway.
Yes, it's very large. It's certainly the largest study that's been done of running shoes, period. And most of the studies in the past that have been done have been quite small, and not to malign any researchers, but they've often been funded by running shoe companies. This case, the military set out to see whether assigning shoes based on the shape of your foot worked because they were doing it. They were putting quite a bit of money into it, and they wanted to know whether this money was being well spent. So they took a really large group of recruits, and as they were going into basic training, they either assigned them shoes based on whether they had a high arch, whether they were pronators or not, and they followed them through basic training when many people get injured. And they found that there was no difference whatsoever when they gave the people shoes based on the shape of their foot and when they gave them shoes almost completely at random. And probably, I don't want to make a blanket statement, but probably avoid the really heavy motion control shoes. Mm-hmm. They certainly, in all the studies that have been done recently, produced the highest injury rate.
Of course, the other hot topic these days is barefoot running. There's all sorts of attention being paid to that. Have you looked into that as well?
Well, I've certainly looked into the science of barefoot running, which is still pretty sketchy. And I know barefoot running is very popular. And when I wrote a column about it, we got a lot of comments and people are very evangelical about it. And I've run barefoot and it's fun. I will certainly say if you're running somewhere where there are no thorns, no glass, nothing that can hurt you, it can be fun. The science suggesting that it's the natural way to run is still sketchy. And there is some emerging evidence that if you've grown used to running in shoes, then your whole body adjusts to running in shoes. You are actually, you know, a shoed runner naturally at that point. When you take shoes off, you wind up frequently with a number of sore muscles and sometimes injuries. And it's not clear that it's the best way for everyone to run. It's certainly the best way for some people to run. If you want to do it gradually, do it slowly. Do not just throw your shoes away and run 10 miles.
One of the things that a lot of people have done to try to avoid injury in running and other sports is to stretch beforehand, to try to loosen up your muscles. Science suggests that may have been a mistake all these years, that stretching seems to feel good, but maybe the wrong thing to do exactly.
Yes, and that's another one of the really pervasive myths of exercise. If you go out to a youth soccer field on any Saturday morning, you'll see all the kids sitting on the ground, reaching for their toes and holding it. That's known as static stretching, where you hold a pose for at least 30 seconds or so. And most of us were taught that that's how you warm up. That's how you get ready for an exercise session. In fact, the science now shows that's exactly the wrong thing to do. What that does, it does not lengthen your muscles. It does not make them looser or more flexible. It actually causes a neuromuscular response, a response in both your brain and the muscle that tightens it up, that makes it harder to produce power because the brain thinks you're about to rip that muscle and it actually pulls it shorter so that it's protecting it. And they've done some very good studies showing that after people do static stretching, they can't jump as high and they can't run as fast. Stretching, by and large, will not increase the length of your muscles. That's pretty much genetically set. If you stretch, a group of scientists did a very interesting study of the muscles of a number of athletes, and they found that only athletes who stretched for hours a day over the course of months produced any permanent change in the length of any of their muscles. The rest of us, we're not doing anything when we stretch except possibly making ourselves feel a little better, but it's not going to decrease the incidence of injury. There's virtually no evidence that shows that. And static stretching, the reach for your toes and hold it before an exercise session, may well make you perform worse.
You know, the other thing about exercise these days is that everybody talks about what a great benefit is if you want to lose weight. It does seem as though exercise would be the silver bullet. There are even those who suggest that if you exercise, you continue to use up calories faster after you stop. Is any of that true? Does the science suggest that there is value, as one assumes, in exercise?
Yes and no. And I'm sorry to bring somewhat discouraging news, but exercise is not a magic bullet in terms of weight loss. And another myth that has been very pervasive about exercise is that if you go out and run moderately for 30 minutes, you will continue to burn lots of calories afterwards, that you have revved up your metabolism somehow. Well, they did a very elegant experiment at the University of Colorado in which they had people stay in a large room that is capable of measuring exactly how many calories you're burning and what percentage of them are fat and carbohydrates. Obviously, you want to burn more fat if you're trying to lose weight. And what they found was that after their volunteers rode a bike for 30 minutes, they not only didn't burn any more calories the remainder of the day, they actually burned less fat. So the lesson of that and the lesson of other very good science about exercise and weight loss is it still all comes down to calories in and calories out.
Well, thank you. It doesn't sound as though you are going to run out of science to examine, does it? This is getting bigger and bigger all the time.
Yes. And what's particularly interesting is that there's so many, I guess you will call them myths, that are entrenched about exercise. And a lot of them are only now being put to the test scientifically. And it'll be interesting to see how many of them stand the test and how many of them turned out to be purely myths.
Gretchen Reynolds writes the Phys Ed column for the New York Times Magazine. Jason Robillard isn't waiting for the science to catch up. Robillard has found what works for him: barefoot running. He's a barefoot ultramarathon runner and founder of Barefoot Running University. He told Steve Paulson about the technique and why he's a fan.
Why are you so gung-ho about barefoot running? I mean, it seems that Nike and other companies have perfected the science of taking care of our feet. Well, what's wrong with shoes?
Well, my history with barefoot running comes from injury backgrounds. When I first took up running races in a competitive sense, I experienced a fair number of injuries that are typical running injuries. In my quest to try to solve the injury riddle, I came across some research about barefoot running, tried it out, and it did indeed solve my injury problems. Since that time, I've tried to spread the word to other people that may be in a similar situation.
So why is it healthier to run barefoot?
Generally, it comes down to an impact issue. Most barefoot runners would agree barefoot running in and of itself isn't necessarily the reason there's a reduced injury rate. It has more to do with your form. Barefoot runners tend to take shorter steps. They tend to land with less force. Essentially, you're using your body as a shock absorber, your ankle, your feet, your knees, your hips, versus, you know, 1 inch of some sort of rubber compound in the sole of your shoe.
Isn't the problem when people run with shoes, typically they land on their heels, and that's what causes a lot of the injuries?
Yeah, they land on their heels, and they will land slightly in front of their center of gravity, which creates all kinds of problems. It creates a lot of shock, and that shock will be transmitted up your leg, to your knees, to your hips, to your back. We refer to it as overstriding. If you watch a typical road race, you'll see that quite a bit. It's pretty frequent.
So when you run barefoot, then, you land on a different part of your foot?
Yeah, you land more on the mid, what we call the midfoot, pretty much the area between your heel and your toe, maybe slightly towards the front, and then slowly or gently allow your heel to touch the ground.
Do you run as fast when you run barefoot?
Yeah, I do. For most distances above like a 5K distance, I'll run noticeably faster barefoot.
And how do you explain that?
Probably efficiency. There's a fatigue factor. There's some research out there that suggests that barefoot running is about 5% more efficient as far as the amount of oxygen used. So you have that advantage. And also, there's just less stress on your body. I like to run really long distances, you know, ultra marathons, 50-mile, 100-mile races. And once you get up to that distance, you're taking so many steps during the race. If you don't have a very soft landing, there's a really powerful cumulative effect that comes into play.
Now, there's an obvious question here. It would seem that you have to have really tough feet. I mean, especially if you're running in cities. There's glass around, there are pebbles, and then in the winter, there's snow. How do you deal with that?
As far as the debris, that's the number one question that I get from non-barefoot runners. You know, how do you avoid glass? How do you avoid dog droppings? I even get questions about how to avoid hypodermic needles, which always made me wonder where people run. But for the most part, we learn to avoid this stuff in our path. You develop a lot of skills as far as watching where you're going. It's almost like building eye-foot coordination. You develop almost an instinctive sense of knowing where your foot should land.
That sounds harder, though, than you're making it out to be. I mean, it sounds like you'd have to be constantly vigilant, and you'd have to be staring at the ground always right in front of you.
It does take a little bit of time, and it depends on the terrain that you're running on. Asphalt is very easy. Usually you can see any significant debris probably anywhere from 25 to 50 yards ahead. So you can fix your gaze at a fairly distant point. Trail running gets a little bit more difficult depending on how rough the trail is or how much, you know, if there's a lot of roots, if there's a lot of rocks. You do have to shorten that gaze down. But it's a skill you develop, and it doesn't take very long to develop those skills.
What happens if you do step on a piece of glass or a sharp twig?
The other skill that you develop is a very good tactile sense. And there's some people within the barefoot running community, myself included, that believe that it's almost like an instinct. If you step on something that would cause some sort of injury, it's almost as if your foot melts around the debris. If you step on something like a thorn or a sharp rock or a piece of glass, you'll instantly feel the pain from that and react by shifting your weight in such a way as to not press your foot down on that specific point.
What you're describing sounds like such a physical, a tactile sense of running. I mean, this is not just getting from here to there. This is you are feeling all of this in your feet. I am wondering if this really changes the experience of running.
It does. One of the things that I've noticed about barefoot runners, as it increases in popularity, I see more and more barefoot runners. It's hard not to smile when you're barefoot running, even in really long races where your entire body may hurt. It's such a freeing sensation to run barefoot. It almost takes you back to your childhood.
What I find puzzling about all of this is that we have had such advances in shoe technology over the last few decades, and shoes are getting more expensive. They are presumably getting more technologically proficient, and there are these high-priced running shoes. Isn't the whole point of those shoes to make it easier and safer to run?
You would think so. This is actually a very hotly debated topic between the shoe running population and the barefoot running population. Most barefoot runners would contend that shoes have been developed not based on any scientific evidence or any sort of research that will lead to a reduction in injuries. Most people will try on a pair of running shoes in the store. They'll have a store clerk that will maybe have them jog a few feet in front of the shoe display, and that's the extent that they have of trying out shoes. And most running shoes, when you try them on in the store, they feel very cushioned, very soft. It seems like it would be a very good, you know, it'd be something very good to run in.
Isn't it? I mean, isn't it better to have a more cushioned shoe?
Well, the idea is the more cushioning you have under your foot, the greater the likelihood that your form is going to suffer. When you lose that tactile sensation of the ground and the proprioception of, you know, your foot position, you can do a lot of things as far as form that will lead to injury. The main one being you just land a lot harder.
So are there many elite runners who run barefoot? I mean, for instance, runners in the Olympics?
Not usually. This is another hotly debated topic, why there's not more elite runners that are running barefoot. Part of it probably has to do with the monetary advantage of having a shoe sponsorship deal. Probably part of it also has to do with performance. Once you're at an elite level and you know you're running at a very fast speed at any distance, there can be some advantage to having some sort of shoe on your foot. The interesting thing is to look at the shoes that are worn by, you know, Olympic runners. They tend to be very minimalist. They're racing flats. They have a thin sole. The heel isn't raised at all. They're very lightweight. They're definitely not the typical highly padded shoe that you find most recreational runners running in.
Do you find differences depending on what country you're looking at? I mean, Kenya, for instance, is famous for its long distance runners. Do they have different kinds of shoes, or are they more likely to run barefoot?
Well, the idea behind that seems to be many Kenyan runners start off at a young age running barefoot, more for financial reasons than anything else. Their running form is nearly identical to the running form that most barefoot runners use. So the idea behind that is, you know, from a very young age, they learned proper running form, presumably from running barefoot, and they're able to translate that into a high level of performance later on.
Do you see this as a growing movement, running barefoot?
Chris McDougall's book, Born to Run, really sort of energized the barefoot running movements. Prior to that book being published, the barefoot running movement was relatively small. It was widely scattered. We had a handful of really well-known barefoot runners that were sort of the leaders of a very small movement. Since that book has been published, the larger running community has really started to accept barefoot running. And more runners are turning towards it, if not running barefoot full-time, making a switch to more minimalist shoes, or even adding barefoot running as part of their running routine. You know, they'll do a few miles per week barefoot.
Jason Robillard is a barefoot ultramarathon runner and the founder of Barefoot Running University. He spoke with Steve Paulson. To find out more about barefoot running and the books and music in this hour, stop by our website. It's ttbook.org. You can become a Facebook fan of To the Best of Our Knowledge there, too. Just follow the link. Coming up next, what novelist Haruki Murakami talks about when he talks about running. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Haruki Murakami has been named among the world's greatest living novelists. Born in Japan, Murakami's novels and short stories have been translated into 42 languages, adapted to stage and film, and been honored with critical acclaim and awards. Most recently, his novel Kafka on the Shore won the Franz Kafka Prize. Murakami is also an avid runner and triathlete, and he writes about his life as a runner in What I Talk About When I Talk About Running. Here's a collection of readings from the book. I began living in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the end of May of this year, and running has once again been the mainstay of my daily routine ever since. I'm seriously running now. By seriously, I mean 36 miles a week. In other words, 6 miles a day, 6 days a week. It would be better if I ran 7 days, but I have to factor in rainy days and days when work keeps me too busy. There are some days, too, when, frankly, I just feel too tired to run. Taking all this into account, I leave 1 day a week as a day off. So, at 36 miles a week, I cover 156 miles every month, which, for me, is my standard for serious running. I'm often asked what I think about as I run. Usually, the people who ask this have never run long distances themselves. I always ponder the question. What exactly do I think about when I'm running? I don't have a clue. On cold days, I guess I think a little about how cold it is, and about the heat on hot days. When I'm sad, I think a little about sadness. When I'm happy, I think a little bit about happiness. Random memories come to me, too. And occasionally, hardly ever really, I get an idea to use in a novel. But really, as I run, I don't think much of anything worth mentioning. I just run. I run in a void. Or maybe I should put it the other way. I run in order to acquire a void. But as you might expect, an occasional thought will slip into this void. People's minds can't be a complete blank. Human beings' emotions are not strong or consistent enough to sustain a vacuum. What I mean is, the kinds of thoughts and ideas that invade my emotions as I run remain subordinate to that void. Lacking content, they are just random thoughts that gather around that central void. The thoughts that occur to me while I'm running are like clouds in the sky, clouds of all different sizes. They come and they go, while the sky remains the same sky as always. The clouds are mere guests in the sky that pass away and vanish, leaving behind the sky. The sky both exists and doesn't exist. It has substance and at the same time doesn't. And we merely accept that vast expanse and drink it in. Whenever I feel I don't want to run, I always ask myself the same thing. You're able to make a living as a novelist working at home, setting your own hours, so you don't have to commute on a packed train or sit through boring meetings. Don't you realize how fortunate you are? Believe me, I do. Compared to that, running an hour around the neighborhood is nothing, right? Whenever I picture packed trains and endless meetings, this gets me motivated all over again, and I lace up my running shoes and set off without any qualms. If I can't manage this much, I think, it'll serve me right. I say this knowing full well that there are lots of people who'd pick a crowded train and attending meetings any day over running every day for an hour. At any rate, that's how I started running. 33, that's how old I was then. Still young enough, though no longer a young man. The age that Jesus Christ died. The age that Scott Fitzgerald started to go downhill. That age may be a kind of crossroads in life. That was the age when I began my life as a runner. And it was my belated, but real, starting point as a novelist. In 1983, Murakami was offered the chance to travel to Athens, Greece, for Runner's World magazine. Since he was writing about running, Murakami thought, why not run the 26-mile course from Athens to the city of Marathon, the course along which battle messengers routinely traveled? The day was sweltering hot, as summers in Greece often are, a fact Murakami hadn't taken into consideration. It was so hot you had to stare at dogs for a minute before you could tell if they were alive or dead. He started in Athens before sunup. The course was unremarkable, the road littered with dead cats and dogs. Later on, the wind from the sea picked up. I passed 22 miles. I've never run more than 22 miles, so this is terra incognita. On the left is a line of rugged, barren mountains. Who could ever have made them? On the right, an endless row of olive orchards. Everything looks covered in a layer of white dust, and the strong wind from the sea never lets up. What is up with this wind? Why does it have to be this strong? At around 23 miles, I start to hate everything. Enough already. My energy has scraped the bottom, and I don't want to run anymore. I feel like I'm driving a car on empty. I need a drink. But if I stopped here to drink some water, I don't think I could get running again. I'm dying of thirst, but lack the strength to even drink water anymore. As these thoughts flit through my mind, I gradually start to get angry. Angry at the sheep happily munching grass in an empty lot next to the road. Angry at the photographer snapping photos from inside the van. The sound of the shutter grates on my nerves. Who needs this many sheep anyway? But snapping the shutter is the photographer's job, just as chewing grass is the sheep's. So I don't have any right to complain. Still, the whole thing really bugs me to no end. My skin's starting to rise up in little white heat blisters. This is getting ridiculous. What's with this heat, anyway? I pass the 25-mile mark. Just one more mile. Hang in there, the editor calls out cheerfully from the van. Easy for you to say, I want to yell back, but I don't. The naked sun is blazing hot. It's only just past 9 a.m., but I feel like I'm in an oven. The sweat's getting in my eyes. The salt makes my eyes sting. And for a while, I can't see a thing. I wipe away the sweat with my hand, but my hand and face are salty too, and that makes my eyes sting even more. Beyond the tall summer grasses, I can just make out the goal line, the Marathon Monument at the entrance to the village of the same name. It appears so abruptly that at first I'm not sure if that's really the goal. I'm happy to see the finish line, no question about it, but the abruptness of it makes me mad for some reason. Since this is the last leg of the run, I want to make a last, desperate effort to run as fast as I can. But my legs have a mind of their own. I've totally forgotten how to move my body. All my muscles feel like they've been shaved away with a rusty plane. The finish line. I finally reach the end. The run from Athens to Marathon took me 3 hours and 51 minutes. Not exactly a great time, but at least I was able to run the whole course by myself. My only companions, the awful traffic, the unimaginable heat, and my terrible thirst. I guess I should be proud of what I did, but right now, I don't care. What makes me happy right now is knowing that I don't have to run another step. Most of what I know about writing I've learned through running every day. These are practical, physical lessons. How much can I push myself? How much rest is appropriate? And how much is too much? How far can I take something and still keep it decent and consistent? When does it become narrow-minded and inflexible? How much should I be aware of the world outside? And how much should I focus on my inner world? To what extent should I be confident in my abilities, and when should I start doubting myself? I know that if I hadn't become a long-distance runner when I became a novelist, my work would have been vastly different. How different? Hard to say. But something would have definitely been different. In any event, I'm happy I haven't stopped running all these years. The reason is I like the novels I've written, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what kind of novel I'll produce next. Since I'm a writer with limits, an imperfect person living an imperfect, limited life, the fact that I can still feel this way is a real accomplishment. Calling it a miracle might be an exaggeration, but I really do feel this way. And if running every day helps me accomplish this, then I'm very grateful to running. Readings from the book What I Talk About When I Talk About Running by Haruki Murakami. Murakami is the critically acclaimed author of several books of short stories and novels. His latest is called Kafka on the Shore. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 829A, On Running. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Ann Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.